Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Welcome to Hollywood Wolfpack with Kaya Alexander, featuring in-depth interviews and insights with professionals in the entertainment business. Get everything you need to navigate your above-the-line career right here. This podcast is often recorded live in front of Kaya students in the Entertainment Business School. You can find out more at entertainmentbusinessschool.com. Hollywood Wolfpack is the new face of entertainment business wisdom. Enjoy the show.
Hi and welcome. I am Kaya Alexander, your host of the show, here today with my special guest, who is an artist, writer, director, and basically the man who I want to be when I grow up, Andrew Levitas. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you. I am a big fan of your work, having discovered you through the film that you directed starring Johnny Depp, Minamata. How did this project find you? How did you find this project?
Sure. So it's one of those weird ones that goes back to the, you know, formative years of being a person even before realizing I was going to someday grow up to be an artist. And I had fallen in love with Eugene Smith's work. I must have been 10 or 12 or 14 years old. And I didn't really know what I was looking at, and I didn't really know why I loved the work, right? At the time, you know, I remember seeing some of it, some of the Minamata work, but other work too from Pacific Theater. And seeing it and feeling strange and seeing, I vividly remember at that age, looking at these images, of course, not knowing that it was Eugene Smith specifically, but somehow being presented with this work and realizing I was looking at pictures that I shouldn't like, right? That the subject matter of the pictures were upsetting, right? A GI holding a baby in its arms, covered in blood and dirt, a handicapped child in a bathtub, you know, these sort of things that I shouldn't have felt connected to or felt sort of a gravitational pull with. And they should have made me feel bad because of what, at least I thought they should have made me feel bad because that's what I was seeing, but they didn't. And it always stuck with me and I was always fascinated by that. And so I started to seek out more and more images and try to understand. Wasn't as thoughtful as it sounds today, but at that age, but looking for work that, whether it was paintings, photography, a lot of photography, or even films that I had access to at that age that spoke to me, but in a way I didn't expect, right? Of course, when I got older and started to understand what I was looking at, it was because there was both sides of that same conversation there, right? You were seeing the best of humanity and the worst of humanity in the same image, right? And so I, as a person that I am today or then, keyed in on the best of what humanity can be and what the best we can offer each other. And I always just stayed fascinated with that idea. And so my work, whether it was my sculptural work, books of poetry I've written, films I've wanted to make, it always played with this idea of showing the best in the moments of the worst, right? And how expressive that could be and all that and trying to find that thing. So Eugene Smith, his work was with me for, you know, since I was a little boy. And then on another part of my life, I progressed and got deeper and deeper into wildlife conservation and the environmental, various environmental groups and learnings, I guess. And I suddenly became the person when I would sit on panels to talk, where I'd sit on a panel and it would be me and a bunch of much more impressive environmentalists or conservationists. And we'd sit on these panels and you'd have 500 people in the audience and then ask questions. And all of the other panelists, the scientists, these guys would just be depressing, doom and gloom. Everything was terrible. The world is over. We got nothing to do. And you'd see the audience's faces just sort of drop and feel like, well, I mean, if there's nothing we can do, there's nothing we can do. And I was always the one kind of talking about the best things and here are the changes. And, you know, I've been teaching at a university for a decade. And, you know, in the first year I was there, every kid came in with a, you know, I teach young, like college kids, you know, every kid would come into class with the plastic bottle. You know, decade later, there's not a plastic bottle on campus. You know, things like that, little bits and pieces. You know, if my kids ever saw me do certain things, drink out of a plastic straw or do things, they would lose their mind at me. My kids are 4 and 7, you know, like there is real progress. Anyway, so I'm always talking about that and trying to be telling stories that are uplifting, stories of success, stories of how we can do better. And so I became aware of the Minamata story because it actually is, post the time of the film, it is an example of great success globally, right? So the world came together because of this work, but the world came together. The Minamata Convention is an incredible success. We're still pushing, we're still fighting, but around the world, people suddenly took notice and, you know, did something. So I was hyper aware of that. I was hyper aware of Eugene Smith. And then suddenly I get a phone call that says, hey, we think you're the perfect person to shepherd this project, on one side. On the other side, you know, there's a really good chance that Johnny Depp wants to do this. And you two are like the only people that could crack this code. So like, okay, I mean, sounds fun, but you know, you're speaking my language. I don't know if Johnny's the right guy, but I'm happy to do it. And this was before anything crazy had happened in Johnny's life. So I got on an airplane. I was living in London at the time, but I got on an airplane, went to LA for what was meant to be about a 45-minute meeting. And for like 12 hours or something, we talked about everything except for the movie. We talked about photography. We talked about the purpose of making cinema. We talked about literature. We talked about the environment. We talked about how to make something and what the goals of making a film like this would be, which was to inspire, to uplift, to educate, to move policy, but certainly to touch people in a way that would make them walk out of a movie theater and go, I actually have a voice I can use. I can link arms with my friends. I have power within me and I can be the change. And you know, we agreed on all those things and literally never talked, didn't spend 1 second on a script, story, any of it, just what the objectives were. And that was it. And then, you know, we spoke every day for, you know, a couple of years until we finished the film.
For everybody listening who hasn't yet seen the film, it is a movie about one of the world's greatest environmental disasters. So would you say a few words about that and the actual subject matter and how it did change policy? I'm so curious to know.
Sure. So there's a lot to unpack in terms of the history of Minamata and Minamata disease and the poisoning, but the sort of broad strokes are a factory called the Chiso Corporation was poisoning the bay or was putting pumping methylmercury into the Bay of Minamata. They realized that there was a problem with the fish that were being caught in the bay, and people were eating them in this small coastal town. So they essentially were buying up the fish and not allowing for the fish to make it to market so that the general public wasn't getting sick. But of course, they never admitted that there was this problem, and it was all done behind the scenes. And so the general public was somewhat insulated against this outside of Minamata, but all the fishing community in Minamata were certainly eating all of the fish.
Was this the '60s? This was like the '60s.
So, one of the heartbreaking things about this was that this went on for about 50 years, and continues to go on today. Not the mercury being in the water, but the denials, the sort of corporate and political cover up that is an ongoing one, denying the existence of certain victims, denying the existence of wrongdoing, all of this stuff. And so what happened, of course, is that the women pregnant women were eating the fish, and the placenta, you know, pulls things like mercury out of it and pumps it into the children. So aside from older, from, you know, grown-ups starting to have various symptoms, children were being born horribly deformed and unable to fend for themselves. And the government and the corporation denied it for decades. And there have been multiple lawsuits and all this stuff, and they just denied it. And so, you know, when we went to Minamata to meet with some of the patients, the ones that were still alive and then their families, you know, they have been through a lot. They have been through a lot of lawsuits, a lot of protesting, a lot of trying to be heard, trying to be seen, breaking through normal societal boundaries and cultural boundaries that they were bound for. You know, this stuff happens in, you know, in America, you know, we burn down the house, but in Japan, it's a bit of a different thing. Very difficult. And there was a lot of shame and shaming of these folks, even though it had nothing to do with it. It wasn't their fault. They were victims. And so it was delicate to rip that Band-Aid off. But one of the most inspiring sort of calls to arms that I've ever heard was sitting in a room with some of these folks who have been through more than anyone ever should go through. And having them basically say, like, tell our story. We're willing to go through this again, but it's not going to change our life. But we want to make sure there aren't more Minamatas in the world. And it was, you know, one of those things that you really, you take on. And I shared with every crew member, every cast member that came on board after that. So they all understood, you know, what was at stake. There's a lot of pain that was going to be felt by folks just seeing it all over again, feeling it again. That said, one of the hopes, but long shots, was seeing policy and awareness change primarily in Japan from this film. And, you know, it, amazingly and wonderfully, the film performed extremely well in Japan. When we were making the film, every Japanese distributor rejected taking on the film. Once they saw the film, every Japanese distributor fought for the rights to buy the film.
Oh my God, I have chills.
It was amazing. And you know, they just didn't believe we would do it right, that we would do it with, not just in terms of the quality of the film, but take a real view, that we would speak to a Japanese audience, right? That we would take the time to think about what does a Japanese audience expect to see? How can we present it? And how can we do it in a way that they would absorb it? And, you know, the film was in theaters for, gosh, almost a year. Constant screenings in theaters, doing incredibly well. A lot of articles everywhere from, you know, political pages to the more gossipy type pages, Hollywood type pages in Japan. And it has changed the lives of these patients. There is almost universal knowledge of Minamata disease now in Japan. There's almost universal knowledge that there are people struggling to be heard and seen. And there's a lot more support that's going that way. And, you know, most of the country that has denied the existence of this event in the first place has had to really sit up and take notice. And, you know, textbooks have been changed in Japan so that children are learning about this history. And the only thing worse than having your life stolen from you is having it not exist. And so, you know, these people are really being remembered or being celebrated. So it's really fantastic.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
That is so fantastic. I'm really interested in the social impact space. And so often the films that are social impact are docs. And here you've achieved this with this scripted film that has really opened hearts. I mean, I came across your movie because I was diagnosed with mercury poisoning. And I was talking about it on Twitter and became friends with David Kessler, who's like, you really need to see Minamata. And has since have been treated for it and all the rest and, you know, pulled the mercury out of my system. But there was it was pretty harrowing there for a while. And then you realize, you know, we all share the same earth and we're being exposed to these things. And it's really important to have these conversations because of course they're affecting us, you know, as human beings are affecting the animals. And there's a lot there that needs to be done. What I really loved about the film, it was so touching. I mean, you know, really made me cry because it was so moving. The deep true story of his life, of what he was going through, his pain, but also putting himself on the line for these people. And it was so beautifully filmed. And every single shot was just so gorgeous that it was just this moving portrait. It was just a beautiful, beautiful movie. I would love to know what has come of that social impact work in this film for both yourself, like what future projects are you working on? And also what came of this film? And, you know, were there any policies changed, you know, that came out of the film?
Sure. So yeah, like I have said, a lot changed in Japan and is continuing to, right? The biggest hurdle that you have as that you have in terms of changing policy in the modern era is lack of awareness. And so, you know, stories like this that are told from an honest lens that that, you know, you mentioned the beauty of the photography. So we felt a responsibility to present the film in a way that was both reflective of a great artist like Eugene Smith. So, you know, a big part of the film is from his point of view and it has to feel of that quality. So as artists ourselves, we're going, well, we have to step up our game. How would this look? How should this feel? Why should it feel this way? And how does that play in and support our story? But also having an interest in what the film did, not as a film, but what the film did as a piece of work that's out there speaking to people. If you don't find a way to make people lean in and instead people have to turn away, you lose the impact, right? Our goal is to say, this is a beautiful thing. Come look. The closer you look, the closer you come, the more your heart will open, the more you will see yourself, the more you will see your neighbor, the more you will see your cousins and you feel part of this same community, right? Because there are 1,000 different environmental issues happening at the same time, but they're all being compartmentalized and localized in terms of how they're talked about, which marginalizes all of us instead of saying, okay, we're the millions together. We're the billions together. Like we have the power to do something about this. You know, there was I feel bad to excuse the language, to shit on the what do they call the ASPCA. I love the ASPCA. Okay. But they had a commercial when I was younger, that had this beautiful Sarah McLachlan song on it.
Right? Yeah, I remember.
And they must have been really well financed. And so they had, thousands of this commercial just playing all the time. Every time
you're watching. The Arms of the Angel. Absolutely.
The Arms of the Angel. It was on and on and on and on. By the time, you know, you'd seen this commercial, and the commercial, for those of you who don't know it, was images. So it would start with, you know, In the Arms of the Angels, beautiful song. And then the images were tortured animals, tortured dogs, things. Like, I mean, just horrific, horrific images. And by the fifth time, by the 10th time, you know, you could hear like a single note from that song and you would either get up to go to the bathroom, just turn away, do something else, change the channel. You couldn't engage. You wouldn't look at it. It was too much, right? There was no beauty in it. There was no elegance in it. It wasn't trying to draw you in. It was trying to shock you. These are things that happen. And I think what we've learned is that shocking people in that way, it just makes you turn away, right? We had something to say, the same thing that Gene Smith said, which was that the world is beautiful. Humanity is beautiful. There's so much here to look at and engage with, right? A child that's been horribly disfigured and had this horrible life being handicapped in this way, but the love between her and her mother and the love between her mother and her can make your heart explode and shows you the goodness. And so we needed to create the film, not just in terms of the narrative, but how we presented it visually to the audience and also musically to the audience, that made you go, not go, oh, but actually go, oh, wow, I want to see more. That's a beautiful picture. That's a beautiful thing. And I can see the beauty and reflect and have a conversation with it.
I love that. It goes back to Plato, you know, the good, the true, and the beautiful. And good can be really hard to pin down. And truth is like, how do we even talk about truth? But then beauty is the doorway in, because it does open us up. It does open our hearts and call us to lean in, like you were saying. I love the way that you put that. As I was looking up your work online, I haven't had the pleasure of going to one of your shows. I hope to at some point. But I was looking up your metal work, your photography. You have clearly a deep relationship with beauty. What is that like for you?
Oh, I don't know. I guess like you develop an aesthetic. I never really work towards an aesthetic for the sake of an aesthetic. I guess I do like making beautiful objects. And I guess in a way, you know, like I was talking about earlier with Smith's work, in a way, I guess I can hide almost Trojan horse, more complex ideas that I actually care about inside of more beautiful packaging, right? So my bigger sculptures, I can add all this meaning, I could add all these ideas, I could add some pretty harrowing stuff into it. But when you look at it, it's still beautiful. I think it draws you in. I think we all are just naturally attracted to things that are beautiful. They don't have to be traditionally beautiful. And so it's probably a defense mechanism at this point, you know, just like make pretty things that people will look, and then I can, like,
I love that. you gotta get the medicine down with a spoonful of sugar.
That's it.
I love that. So what's next for you? Where's your focus?
Sure. So I've got a bunch of sculptural projects I'm working on, almost entirely about wildlife conservation, and sort of the connective piece. The last, for those that won't have seen that work, the last exhibition was about industrial pollution specifically, right? So big sculptures that speak, big beautiful sculptures that speak to those sorts of ideas, right? The stuff I'm working on now really is trying to focus and narrow in on the idea that wildlife conservation is very much connected to human conservation, right? Like saving animals is saving us, and saving the communities around them, and how we're connected, both in some ways that are more well reported, like, you know, the fact that terrorist groups are responsible, the same terrorist groups that might be trying to blow you up, are the same terrorist groups that are poaching, or are oftentimes poaching rhino or elephant or lion, or deeply involved in the illegal wildlife trade. But also on smaller things, the way that wildlife impacts an ecosystem and how that traces its way to you. So trying to pack all this information into a sculptural series. And so that's the really fun part. And then teaching at NYU. And then there's quite a few films that I've written and been working on to pull together. And I think, you know, no announcements today, but I think we're very likely to be back at work very soon.
Oh, I love that. What are you teaching at NYU?
I've been teaching for over a decade now. I teach a course called The Artist's Mind, about creativity, about specificity, about creating process to replicate good work, replicate your own good work, right? So the theory behind it is that so many artists across all disciplines will, you know, maybe make one great work, or the first great work or the second great work, and then it's quite hard to keep the tank full, to keep yourself engaged and fresh. And so I've built a process that I've built over the 30 years for myself, which sort of walks you through how to build, or some examples of how to build your own process, right? So if you're a filmmaker, here are the 7 other things that have nothing to do with film that you can do while you're writing a screenplay, or these are ways to get deeper into your projects. If you're a architect, I mean, it's open to all creatives. I curate the class, but if you're an architect and you're, constantly creating, but you need new ways to view the world, sort of how to package that for oneself to just go, okay, if I do these steps, I can get there. It doesn't make you better, it just makes you, more efficient.
So many of my listeners are above the line creatives, like writers and directors like yourself. So what tips do you have for them coming out of process and teaching process?
I think the process is more, has a bigger role to play than people give it credit for in the artistic community. There's a lot of this freestyling, right? Like just, oh, I'll do it this way, I'll do it that way. Like, I don't know, this project, right? For me, the more prepared you are, the more time, there's a finite amount of time for everything. And so the more prepared you are, whether it's by, the process in which you write, the process in which you create, or the process in which you prep for a film, the more time you'll have for free thinking, the more time you'll have for opportunity, the more time you'll have to make different connections and different, bridge different gaps and have those eureka moments. When you're just having to focus on getting through the slog while staring at a computer screen as you're writing, it's quite difficult to make magic. And I also, in my course, I have quite a few friends come in, and everybody has a different process. All the guys I know that are, men, women, whatever, that are consistently successful and happy, right? It's the ones that have created process for themselves, and they're all different. I have one friend that sits, there's some jetway, some air path or whatever by LAX in LA, where the planes are very low. I guess they're just taking off or just landing. He sits there on the hood of his car staring up, and that's part of his process, and knows that it clears him in a certain way and allows for certain thinking. We all have something different. I paint ideas that are in my films, right? So I'll paint, I will step away from my screenplay and I'll sit down and go, okay, what do I want my audience to feel when they walk out of a movie theater, right? Well, it's one thing to think about it. It's another thing to have to activate it and action it. So I'll, go into my studio and paint whatever that idea is, and then go back and read my screenplay and say, okay, well, at the end of this film, like, I don't think they're going to connect that same emotion I really refined over here is going to play out here. Where I write a lot of poetry about, from the perspective of my different characters, it's just an easier way to get inside their head, right? Write it in their voice. Well, you got to be honest about what their voice sounds like, or else it's your poetry. So these sorts of things. And so I highly recommend everyone find your own path, figure out a way to replicate that thing, because it takes too long otherwise.
Oh my God, I love that. I hope you write a book about it. Yeah. in all your spare time. Oh, come on, Andrew. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Yeah, I get it.
I'm a surfer, and there's so much for me of that. It's like a giant comma in my whole thinking process, where I can go out there and you can't bring a cell phone. You can't. There's nothing you can bring out there except your relationship with everything beyond the sand, the dolphins that come, the mist that comes and goes, the beautiful landscape that is shifting, that is the sea. And it's sometimes, even if I don't catch many waves, it's just being out there and that reset and the quiet of it, is it's just such a quiet space to then come back in with fresh ideas and fresh energy. I don't know anywhere else to go to find that kind of recharge, but it sounds like for you, it's going to painting, it's going to poetry, it's going to dip your brush in another arena that's going to then feed into what you're doing.
Yeah, so it's active. So the idea, what I try to advocate for is actively moving your work forward while doing things that are outside of a final product, right? So writing short story about a character, you know, writing poetry from the perspective of this person, doing a photo essay, storyboarding your movie, but doing it with photography as you walk around your hometown, right? Things that then allow you to move your work forward, but you don't have to sit smashing your face against your computer and wanting to kill yourself all day, right? It's just a different experience. And it's rewarding in itself. It's interesting you mentioned surfing. I always ask my students, you know, oh, does anyone here surf? And, you know, I teach in New York, so there's not as many that will surf. Do you ski or any rock climbers? But using the surfing as an example, right? I think the best training that artists can do in their own time working on, that they could spend their own time working on to progress and find shortcuts into their work and find ways to find more specificity, more clarity in their work, and more of an enjoyable experience being an artist, which is, you know, we have to be responsible to ourselves. We have to feel good. I ask my students, you know, if you're a surfer, if you're not a surfer, you drive down Pacific Coast Highway and you see waves and you turn to your friend in the car and you're like, wow, look at those big waves. Or, oh, there's no waves today. That's about it, right? That's the limitation of the information that you're taking out of the water. But if you're a surfer and you're driving down Pacific Coast Highway, you're immediately going, look at that left. Oh, wow. Look at the right there. Oh, wow. I see what I would do with this. Look how long that is. Whatever the different details and knowledge information you can suck out of it, becomes a much richer experience, right? Absolutely. If you're a rock climber, you look at a rock face. I'm not a rock climber, right? You drive by a rock face, you're like, wow, it's a big cliff. That's the end of it, right? If you're a rock climber, you look at it, you see how you would go, oh, you could climb this. Oh, the texture of the rock is such, you know, all this stuff. And the idea as an artist is to look at everything and notice everything and see how much information you could be pulling out of all of it, right? Whether it's the table you're sat at, whether it's the computer screen you're looking at, whether it's the people you're looking at, whether it's the texture of the light, and be training yourself to just constantly be absorbing all of this. That's something you can do walking around, and you'd be amazed how just going from, you know, sort of like a baseball player sits in a batting cage, hits hits a million balls, just so that when they get actually, you know, pitched a ball in a game, they're ready to hit it because they practice so much. You'll find that you can do this enough and be conscious of it to the point where you just become, it becomes an unconscious reflex to you, and you're just constantly taking it in. And then you sit down to do your work, and you're shocked at the knowledge that you have. You're shocked at the base and wealth of information about the way people's eyes twinkle at a certain moment, the smell of something that you never even thought would have a smell. You know, all this stuff, it's there for you, and it becomes the supporting foundational pieces of any work you do, whether you're a sculptor, a painter, a filmmaker, you know, or just, you know, a lover, whatever.
I love that. It's the art and practice of paying attention. And it's something that we're completely losing, you know, with kids with their eyes buried in the phone and everything else. I was walking my dog yesterday at the dog park. And it's something that I really love is just to be with him in that moment with now what's happening in spring with, oh, these flowers are in bloom now. And oh, there's a hawk, you know, way up on that tree. And like, it puts me into, you know, relationship with everything just in that moment, walking with him and walking past so many people who are with their dogs who are, you know, they have the earphones in and then their eyes are buried in the phone. And I'm just looking at them going like, okay, you missed the hawk, you missed the crow, you missed your dog having this great moment. Like there's so much that is being missed because of this addiction to technology. And I love that that's a huge part of your process is simply immersing yourself and paying attention to the moments. And you know, going back to the surfing, you were talking about being able to read the water. That's relationship. When you have a relationship with an element, when you have a relationship with the nature around you, you can read it and you start to develop that. It's taken me years, you know, and I work with a coach too, and he can see stuff I can't see. And we get out there and he goes, well, you don't have to see it. You just understand it. And he's talking about, you know, the shape of the reef under the water that he's gotten to know for 20 years that I don't know yet because I haven't surfed that spot enough. And he knows that that swell direction is going to hit that reef in that way. And so he's just in this, you know, long-term time relationship also right. with these elements that inform it. I just find all that stuff really fascinating. I wish I liked my process, Andrew. I don't like my
process. You got to change it.
Like, you know, one of the reasons why is it just takes me forever to do anything. I'm also a novelist and you know, every book wants to have 10 years, you know, to be written. And unfortunately, my screenwriting is the same way. It's just like, I'm like a 3D printer. I just go back and forth and back and forth, but there's a discovery that just feels alive until it doesn't anymore. When I know it's done, but yeah, no, it takes forever.
Well, you got to find ways to make it more fun. That's the key. Every year I have, every time I speak to young people, especially in my class, I always get asked the same question, which is like, do you have to be miserable to be successful as an artist? Do you have to go through difficult things to be successful as an artist? And I always find it remarkable that that this is like an ongoing thing that people think. And to me, it's the opposite, right? It's absolutely the opposite. Your work will be better when you feel nourished, enriched, supported, and excited to be there, excited to do it. It's, you know, as artists, we get to basically be our own therapists. And the better you get at it, the happier you feel. So it's kind of great all around.
I love that. And I know that you're a family man too. So does your relationship with your family feed your work?
Yeah. I mean, I think everything feeds the work. I'm getting to have some fun times now because my daughter, who's seven and a half, we've been going out making films on the Bolex. I've got a couple old Bolexes. And so that's quite fun to play around, teach her some of the things that stopped being happy accidents for me, you know, light leaks and things like this, that now you see it, you're like, oh shit, this is not what I was going for. You know, like you have a more clear view on what it is, but for her, you get some film developed and all this other stuff is on it and it's magical. And it's quite exciting to do that. And then, you know, I love watching some of these films again, where I get to watch them. You know, I watched E.T. recently with my 4-year-old and my 7-year-old. And my 4-year-old was uninterested after a few minutes and he left the room. My 7-year-old sat there watching this film and it was 2 hours of amazingness for me because I just sat watching her. And at this point, I know everything that's happening in this film. You're hearing the sound. I'm seeing her eyes like sparkle and glow when she's excited about something and then sad and scared. And it was amazing. It was amazing. So it inspires me to do more. But also the pressure is different, you know, when you have a family. You feel, I think, more of an obligation to having something to say and to saying it and to try to be a positive force in some way in the world. But you also realize that, you know, you have limited time on this earth and you got to be very careful about how you spend it. So
And also you have the support. And I don't know that every artist has that, but I, especially being in the film business, which I've been couched in for about 20 years now, I really do see a lot of success come from having family, having support. It's so much harder to be an artist and find your own enactment of your vision without that kind of support.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It makes sense. I think you have to have an engaged life or you can't make good art. So whether that engagement is surfing all the time, living in your brain, reading and, you know, having a nose in a book, whatever it might be, you know, you got to be doing things you love, because the only way to find out the things you want to talk about is to be exploring the world and engage in the world. So, the more relationships you have with different kinds of people, including your own children and your own parents and other friends and, you know, romantic relationships, the easier it is to start learning what other perspectives feel like, you know. Part of the anecdote of looking at my daughter watching the film is seeing, understanding what it is to be a 7-year-old girl seeing a real movie like that for the first time, right? And what she's seeing, what she's reacting to. You know, there's often these scarier films are not really scary, but they have some scarier elements that the kids don't notice. Or you go to, I took my kids to The Lion King, right, on Broadway, and actually in the West End. And, you know, you've got these actors with like lion heads on them. Okay. Their face is right there. The head is here. Your children don't see the humans. It's amazing.
Well, I just want to ask what you did with your pandemic. Were you somebody who could get all creative, or did it stop you? What happened for you in the pandemic?
So I wrote an opera.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so it sounds ridiculous to say it. I had no business writing an opera. I'm married to a classical singer, and we were out in the woods staying somewhere, and my wife felt really like a responsibility to the public. And so she did, I think, I don't want to say less than the right number, but at least 30 like free online concerts, which like millions of people watched. It was like a Saturday night thing, having a cocktail and singing a bunch of arias and things like that. Our kids got involved, although not on camera. And every now and again, when she needed a male voice, I butchered the singing. But, you know, so I did the best I could. And so we were doing that. And one of my foundations that I work closely with, the Wilderness Foundation, which is all over Africa, but primarily at this point we were working in South Africa, and was how to get people fed, right? How to get people fed and looked after, because if they're not, then they don't have any choice but to go out and kill animals for bushmeat. So they're really working on that and just trying to be as helpful to the, you know, world and our community as we could be.
My students all want you to come back and teach a workshop. Everybody wants to learn from you. Very inspiring.
Thanks for listening to Hollywood Wolfpack. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Please help our pack grow by sharing Hollywood Wolfpack with your friends and colleagues. Give us a rating and write us a review. Kaya loves hearing from you and reads them all. For more on Kaya and the Entertainment Business School, visit entertainmentbusinessleague.com. Until next week, remember, the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack.